I went to see a movie called Evolution. I'm now of the opinion, Mark, that there is a summer movie formula in Hollywood. It's a 12-step thing. You work in these 12 things, you crank out a summer movie.
Yeah.
Evolution followed those 12 steps. You gotta have, like, explosions, dirty jokes, at least one, like, nubile starlet, a funny ethnic character.
Yeah.
And often involves some kind of quasi-pseudo-science fiction.
Yeah.
Like, really, really pseudo-science fiction. This movie just, like, followed all of them, and I felt myself carried along, like, it was like a movie, but it was like making Kool-Aid at the same time. You know the result at the end, and you know what it's going to taste like.
Yeah.
It's not going to taste great, it's not going to taste bad, but there it is, Kool-Aid.
And it's called Look Out For My Love. Mark, do you know the song of Vanilla? Look Out For My Love?
Yeah.
It's a kind of an oldie, but pretty, but it's you know, I like it anyway. It's, but nobody seems to listen. Men with walkie-talkies, men with flashlights waving, up upon the tower, saying Easter Daylight Saving. It's home again to you, babe. You know it makes me wonder, sitting in the quiet slipstream, rolling in the thunder. Look out for my love. 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 Look out for my love.
Henry David Thoreau, a man of the American counterculture. From Civil Disobedience. The mass of men serve the state thus, not as men mainly, but as machines, with their bodies. They're the standing army and the militia, jailers, constables, posse comitatus, etc. In most of these cases, there is no free exercise whatever of the judgment or of the moral sense. But they put themselves on the level with wood and earth and stones, and wooden men can perhaps be manufactured that they will serve the purpose as well. Such command no more respect than men of straw or a lump of dirt. They have the same sort of worth only as horses and dogs. Yet these same are commonly esteemed good citizens. Others, as most legislators, politicians, lawyers, ministers, and office holders, serve the state chiefly with their heads. And as they rarely make any moral distinctions, they are as likely to serve the devil without intending it as God. A very few, as heroes, patriots, martyrs, reformers in the great sense, and men, serve the states with their consciences also, and so necessarily resist it for the most part, and they're commonly treated as enemies by it. A wise man will only be as useful as a man, and will not submit to be clay, and stop a hole to keep the wind away, but leave that office to his dust at least. I'm too high-born to be propertied, to be a second to control, or only useful serving man an instrument to any sovereign state throughout the world. I submit to you the following proposition, that Henry David Thoreau was the original man of the American counterculture. I do not suggest that he was a man who always lived up to his own ideals. He did not. Nor do I suggest that anyone really could. What I do is suggest that without Thoreau's writings, the seminal ideas of American counterculture simply would not exist, or would exist in such a stunted form that would lack his forceful and convincing prose. Without him resisting, protesting, paying his Mexican war tax, Whitman's dictum to resist much, obey little, would have been a lone voice crying out against the repression of the times. From Walden, why should we be in such desperate haste to succeed and in such desperate enterprises? If a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. Let him step to the music which he hears, however measured or far away. Is it not important that he should mature as an apple or an oak? Should he turn his spring into summer? If the condition of things which were made for us is not yet, what were any reality which we can substitute? We will not be shipwrecked in a vain reality. Shall we with pains erect a heaven of blue glass over ourselves, though when it is done, we shall be sure to gaze at still the true ethereal heavens far above, as if the former were not? Henry David rejected the circumscribed ideas about American individualism which were prevalent in his day, which remain present in our own. Consumer culture's idea of being an individual rests upon the notion that you have the choice to paint your walls eggshell white or ivory. Henry David prides us to have a life forged from our deepest identity rather than a lifestyle. To some, however cool they may seem, this will always be a threat. Conventionality in American culture runs deep, even those amongst those who claim to reject it. From Life Without Principle. If a man walk in the woods for love of them half of each day, he is in danger of being regarded as a loafer. But if he spends his whole day as a speculator, shearing off those woods and making the earth bald before her time, he is esteemed an industrious and enterprising citizen, as if a town had no interest in its forest but to cut them down. At the center of Thoreau's counterculturalism are two chief ideas: appreciation of nature for its own sake, and suspicion of commerce for what it does to humane and natural values. Go to some of the literature today of groups like Earth First, and you will read, that, though not in the eloquent prose of Henry David, the same refrain. The earth is not man's resource. The animals do not exist alone for their skins and meat. They exist for their own sakes and are good. They have the right to be let alone and allowed to exist. From Life Without Principle. Man is said to be in the arena in which the battle of freedom is to be fought. But surely it cannot be freedom in merely a political sense that is meant. Even if we grant that the American has freed himself from a political tyrant, he is still the slave of an economical and moral tyrant. Now that the res publica has been settled, it is time to look after the res privata, the private state, to see, as the Roman Senate charged in its consuls, ne quid res privata detrimenti caperat, that the private state received no detriment. In Seattle 1999, the battle for res privata was once again taken up, not only for America, but for the world. When the battles against censorship are fought, the res privata is looked after. when anyone, anywhere, lights up a joint in defiance of an unjust, unconstitutional, tyrannical law, the res privata is being defended. Defend.
What?
I just added that on. Defend. From Walden. I find it wholesome to be alone a greater part of the time. To be in company, even with the best, is soon wearisome and dissipating. I love to be alone. I never found the companion that was so companionable as solitude. We are, for the most part, more lonely when we go abroad among men than when we stay in our chambers. A man thinking or working is always alone. Let him be where he will. Solitude is not measured in the miles of space that intervene between a man and his fellows. The really diligent student is one of the crowded hives of Cambridge College, is as solitary as the dervish in the desert. The farmer can work alone in the field and woods all day, hoeing or chopping, and not feel lonesome, because he is employed. But when he comes home at night, he cannot sit in a room alone, at the mercy of his thoughts. But it must be where he can see the folks and recreate, and as he thinks, remunerate himself for his day's solitude. And hence he wonders how the student can sit alone in the house all night, and most of the day, without ennui and the blues, but does not realize that the student, though in the house, is still at work in his field and chopping in the woods, as the farmer in his, and in turn, seeks the same recreation in society that the latter does, though it may be a more condensed form of it. At the last, there is the self. The self who is countercultural must be alone for much of the time, for he is one who deliberately says, no, I will not go there, do this, do that, jump through your molded hoops, associate with the dead. I will not be but who I am, for I do hear different music. From Life Without Principle. If we have thus desecrated ourselves, as who is not, the remedy will be by weariness and devotion to reconsecrate ourselves and make once more a fane of the mind. We should treat our minds, that is, ourselves, as innocent and ingenuous children, whose guardians are, and be careful of what objects and of what subjects we thrust on their attention. Read not the times, read the eternities. Conventionalities are at length as had as impurities. Even the facts of science may dust the mind by their dryness when they are in a sense of effaced each morning or rendered facile by the dews of fresh and living truth. Knowledge does not come to us by details, but in flashes from heaven. Yes, every thought that passes through the mind helps to wear and tear it, deepen the ruts, which, as in the streets of Pompeii, events how they have been used. How many things there are concerning which we might well deliberate whether we had better know them, had better let their peddling carts be driven, even if the slowest trot or walk over that bright and glorious span, which we trust at last to pass at last from the farthest brink of time to the nearest shore of eternity. Have we no culture, no refinement, but skill only a little of coarsely and serve the devil, to acquire a little worldly wealth or fame or liberty, and make a false show with it, as if we were all husk and shell, with no tender and living kernel to us? Shall our institutions be like chestnut burrs, which contain abortive nuts, perfect only to prick the fingers?
Right on.
Hello.
Welcome, Ralph. Ralph,
this is called denaturized profanity in English. The third commandment in Exodus 27 warns us, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord in vain. You don't say God unless you really mean it. Unfortunately, few of us have ever been much good at respecting this rule. We can't help it. We pick up profanity as children, and later when we are excited or angry, God's name automatically bubbles up to our lips, and we exclaim, God, God, my God, by God, God damn. I heard a surprised three-year-old say, my God, the day before I wrote this. In the post office. God is the immediate witness, the basic interjection, the first word that comes to mind. Hardly even mind, actually, for impulsive swearing is controlled by a much more primitive part of the brain than ordinary speech. Yet the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. What to do? We're forbidden to say what we can hardly help saying. Well, nothing gets the creative wheels turning like a good prohibition. So we... We've devised several sneaky ways to bend the rule without quite breaking it. H.L. Mencken called the results denaturized profanity. Most of it is disguised so well that I never even guessed its original function until recently, or its importance either. Denaturized profanity is so common that a huge proportion of modern English interjections, no matter how innocent sounding, began as masks for some taboo religious word. Section 1 is called Fun with First Letters. That'll be familiar to those of you who've read this essay. The best way to say God without really saying it is to keep the emotional release of the hard G and change the rest of the word. That's where gosh and golly come from, and lots of others. My God, my goodness, goodness gracious, good gravy, Charlie Brown's good grief, by gum, by gad, by Godfrey, and Ireland's begorra and begob. By used to be pronounced like B. The curse God blind me produced the Cockney interjection gore blimey or blimey, and the hard G in the gore, twisted into its sister hard sound hard C, produced another characteristic Cockney interjection, core. Cockneys also say coo. Our forebears turned ah God into both egad and the hard C ecod. Modern Americans use a hard C in holy cow. There's also one in Great Scott. The second oldest God euphemism in English has two hard C's, one at each end, the medieval cock, tweaked from the even earlier gog. My favorite G euphemism is from a 1940s high school yearbook. One girl's pet phrase was, oh, goo.
Never heard that.
Goo.
Oh, goo.
Gumby had a friend named Goo.
Really?
Yeah. Goo the girl. Who's the girl? Remember Goo? Gumby's friend Goo. Gumby? Well, Gumby, Pokey. But there was Goo. Goo is the girl. Blonde hair. That was Goo. Yeah, that was Goo. No, that was Goo. Dude. I used to watch this show at 4 in the morning when I was, you know, out there.
First letter euphemisms do not honor God the Father alone. They exist for all the major characters of Christianity. Jesus appeared as his respelled first syllable, G, whose fancier cousins include G-Wiz, G-Wizzikers, and G-Willikers, plus G's, G's Louise, and Sheesh. We find by Jesus in by George, by Jingo, by Jiminy, by Jerusalem, and the Irish, by Jesus and by Jabbers.
By Gum.
Got that earlier. But thanks for the tip. Jumping Jesus cloaks itself both as Jumpin' Jehoshaphat and the mock Swedish Jumpin' Yimini. Jesus joins Christ in Jesus, Jeepers Creepers, Jiminy Christmas, and Jiminy Crickets. That's where Pinocchio's insect friend Jiminy Cricket comes from in the Disney movie. By Christ becomes, and I kept thinking of Dr. Knickerbocker when I was writing this, by Cracky. Plain Christ becomes Cripes, Cranky, or Criminy. And for Christ's sake becomes the incomparable for crying out loud. And someone remarked that if you say for crying out loud without the initial R, the first syllable sounds like another swear word, which might account for its popularity. Lord, of course, rounds up the L's. Lordy, lore, law, lawsy, my land, land of Goshen, land sakes alive. And a girl I went out with a few months ago came up with another one that I didn't have time to put in here. Lordy Lou. And the M's come out for Mary. In Shakespeare's England, they switched it into Mary, M-A-R-R-Y, as on the first page of As You Like It and a thousand other places. Mary, sir, I am helping you. Modern Americans replace Holy Mary or Holy Mother of God with Holy Moses, Holy Mackerel, Holy Moly. Even Holy Smoly, Sumoly, or Schmoly. The devil gets his due with D's. What the deuce, a dickens of a time, scare the daylights out of him. Plenty of D substitutes exist for damn, too, but we'll save those for later. And of course, we roll out the H's for the devil's realm, hell. What the heck, what the hey? I'm told that members of the Dutch Reformed Church in Ohio and Michigan say, what the hob?
The Haunting of Yusuf. It began in a night seemingly younger than the newborn spring, and yet old, still older than the bright full moon that shone down. It began as so many tales of this kind often do in a tavern. The Sleeping Albatross, to be precise. It began at the table of one Kim T. Young. You know what it began with a T. Just for you.
Thanks.
Kim was, depending on which of the numerous rumors being passed amongst the other patrons you wish to believe, the captain or merely the navigator of one of the two few merchant vessels in the city's harbor. Kim's ship, a full-bellied galleon, was known as the Dawnbreaker in the Eastern tongue. Some saw Kim as a pirate with the darkest heart. Other rumors had Kim as traveler from far-off Uthar, where no man may kill a cat, or that he had sailed his ship upon Blake Halley at Hastur, or voyaged the length of the Yann, even that he had set foot upon Cadeth in the cold waste itself. To the eye, Kim looked to be a standard Easterner, not that many in the city had ever seen an Easterner. His hair was thin and black, drawn back into a long ponytail. Mustache and goatee danced about his mouth. His eyelids drew attention to the man's foreignness and created an illusion of mystique as wispy as a spring morning mist. Even the serving wenches had gotten into the game of speculating about Kim. They wondered if he sported a tail beneath his silken pantaloons. Kim twisted his thin mustachios, trying to decide which of the women had the best chance to find out the truth. It began with, "Ghosts!" cried Chev Yusuf. I should have better cry. "Ghosts!" cried Chev Yusuf. The caravan master sat at Kim's table. They had earlier in the day negotiated a deal on bolts and bolts of silk Kim's ship had carried to harbor. The two had come to the tavern to celebrate the bargain. "Ghosts!" Yusuf repeated into his fourth. It wasn't merely third, Stein. "Ghosts?" questioned Kim. "Ghosts. I've seen them." In this establishment, Kim's eyes danced about the room, searching for some trace of the preternatural. Disappointed, his gaze returned to the caravan master. Chev Yusuf was tanned almost to the point of leather. An eye patch covered his left socket, and a long, cruel scar accompanied it. "The ghosts of Taranthiol." "Taranthiol that was followed by the desert? You do have a higher class of spooks about you, my new friend. And what does a yellow water rat like you know of Taranthiol?" "I know many things," Kim replied. His interest in the night had peaked. He had planned to return to his ship to read a few passages from the writings of the great philosopher before retiring to bed in the full moonlight. Kim liked the moon, liked standing watch beneath it, and his favorite place of all was his moon-watching tower on his aged father's Han at home. But here was a tale of Taranthiol, a legend few scarcely had heard of, a legend of the city that had made the old gods jealous and was thusly destroyed, a tale of that forsaken city's ghosts. "I knew Taranthiol before the desert reclaimed her. I knew her in her glory, her shame." "You must have been very young, Kim. You must have been very young." Kim waved over one of the serving wenches and ordered another wine for himself and a stout for Yusuf. "I was 16 in the first over the wall at the assault," said Yusuf, fellowed. Kim smiled. "Wasn't it centuries since you was last 16? "I've seen them ever since. Not the same one either. Peasant, nobleman, craftsman, I've seen them all. By once I may have seen the pale prince himself." Yusuf's right hand made the sign of a lesser god's blessing. Kim tasted his wine. It was dry and slightly nutty. He pushed Yusuf Stein closer to the man. "But why are you graced with visits by the shades of this long-gone city? Surely they have some sweeter rest to find elsewhere." "For I have something of Taranthiol, a memento of my foolish youth. We were warned by the vizier to bring nothing out of the ruin, but to lay it waste and wreck and rapine." "You did not heed the words of that venerable vizier, did you, said Yusuf?" "No, curse upon me, I did not. A simple trinket, I thought, nothing more." "Something you took. Let me see, something you took. Something valuable, no doubt. A thing cherished among Taranthiol's people." Kim stopped, stroking his goatee in thought. "Not the crown jewel, said Yusuf." Kim smiled a wide smile. "A sword, said Yusuf, just a sword." "A sword," repeated Kim. "Not a large one, not a jeweled one, just a sword." "But whose sword? One of the pale prince's knight's broadswords? Or a sinful merchant's eunuch scimitar? Come tell, Sir Yusuf, whose blade did you spirit out of that land? Whose weapon has become an open invitation for haunting spirits that can find no other rest? Oh, you must tell me, Sir Yusuf, whose sword?" "A woman's," Yusuf said, clutching tightly his stein. He had not drunk in some time, not since his tale had begun to be told. "A mother's, perhaps. That is, if the child she was defending was from her womb." "Mother? Child?" asked Kim. "It is not a pretty thing to destroy a city," Yusuf spoke. "Not pretty even when you were only 16 and believed the words of the clerics and the viziers." Finally he drank. Yusuf emptied his stein and placed it loudly on the table with a deeply hollow thud. The serving wench hurried over with another. Kim threw some coppers upon the wooden table and shooed her away quickly. Gone were thoughts of an upstairs room. Gone were thoughts of tales and a night's romp. Yusuf's story was all that was in Kim's mind. "Hers was the first ghost to find me, but not the last." Yusuf paused, finding that his courage to tell his tale rested at the bottom of his stein. "They come to me to see me die, to see me suffer the fate of Taranthiol, to witness my misery." all these years. They come to me when I'm in danger, when death has my name on his foul tongue. They wait only for death to speak Shab Yusuf and draw me to his rotting bosom. As I passed through the desert without water, they were there. When I defended my caravan from raiders, they were there. When fevers and sickness drove me to bed, they were there as well. Why have you not sold the sword or left it somewhere? At the bottom of a deep well, perhaps. They will not let me, Yusuf said. I've kept it hidden all these years. I have not used it as a sword should be used, not in battle, nor in accolade, or even as trophy in my tent. I hid it from the first day. He reached into his cloak and brought forth an object no more than 3 feet long. Slowly Yusuf unwrapped the burlap covering, revealing his sword plundered from Taranthiol. It was a wide, curving blade. To Kim it resembled a small falchion. It was not jewel.
What?
Falchion? It's like a curved sword. It was not jeweled, but Kim saw the blacksmith's craftsmanship in the weapon. It looked to be a flexible, resilient weapon. Fine leather wrapped about the hilt, and the guard was simple. For an instant, Kim desired to reach out for the sword. He stopped himself. His eyes moved up to Shab Yusuf's. Kim could see the tears in those eyes. He said nothing. Kim Ki-young wrapped his cloak about his shoulders to shield himself from the cold wind blowing off of the harbor. He fashioned his large decorative clasp at the shoulder. It was etched with numerous hermetic sigils. He bid farewell to Shab Yusuf. They would meet tomorrow to trade silk for gold. Kim listened to his own booted steps as he strode to the Dawn Trader. Then another sound came to his ears, the sound of steel being drawn. Kim turned and ran back the way he had come. Shab Yusuf stood before a cut purse. The thief was dressed all in black. A black hood covered her face. She held two long daggers at the ready. At the sight of Kim, the caravan master cried out, "Oh, you try to rob me." The cut purse turned and, seeing Kim, drew back her arm to throw one of her daggers at him. The projectile flew straight for Kim, but the last seconds before it would have struck him, it turned in the air, deflected as if by a strong wind. Kim grasped the clasp of his cloak, beckoning his Vesper air elemental to return to the amulet, and promising an offering of plum wine mixed with blood when he returned to the ship. It was then that Kim saw the ghosts. It was not the scent of sorcery or the sound of magic. It was simply shadows of the other world that Kim sensed. He was sure the cut purse saw nothing. Not a single one of the Legion of Taranthiol who watched Shab Yusuf. How many of them did Yusuf himself see, Kim wondered. Kim looked to the faces of the ghosts. Expectant they were. They were waiting, hoping for something. Surely not just Yusuf's death, as the caravan master had lamented so much about this very night. Kim sensed, and he was a very good sensor, that it was some other dark feature of this night, of this encounter with the city's underworld, that they breathlessly and eternally awaited. Yusuf threw the falchion against the thief. Yusuf was quick. He drew and slashed at his opponent in one smooth motion, but the ghosts were faster. As the blade was coming around towards the thief, the ghost took the hilt in his spectral hand. The blade passed through the cut purse like moonlight. Moon's other dagger buried itself in Shab Yusuf's throat. She grabbed his purse and fled, not even pausing to glance back at Kim. Kim approached Shab Yusuf's body. The ghost of Taranthiol crowded about it. He stared for a moment at the man he had shared an evening with, a man alone except for his ghosts. The falchion lay next to the body. Kim wrapped the sword in the finest silk spun by his father's mulberry eaters. "Damned enchanted swords," he said, looking to the smiling faces floating about him. How long had they waited for this moment? How long till Shab Yusuf took a hold of his trinket, his simple sword, to defend his life? When that moment came, they acted, ripping the very falchion taken from the dead hands of their comrade, grasping the sword and taking its essence with them into the spectral world for just an instant long enough to extract their revenge. A moment Kim stared at them, and then they were gone to imagine eternal peace. Kim Ti-young was never to be visited by the ghost of Taranthiol again. Yeah.
Spooky.
Alright, so I picked out 6 poems from 36 Nocturnes Series 4. And the theme of this series, this fourth series, as I attempted it, was nature. So these poems are nature poems, in as much as I'm able to write nature poems at all. At least try. I try. So there you go. Okay. The first one has a title, All Glory Passeth. I may start with one or two I read last time, but it'll go into one if none of them. All Glory Passeth. The power raised tonight, the mortal tyrant within crushed. The eye roams over pink cheeks, over any slip of flesh revealed, the smoke of a smile, the blind of a finger, the thrill of the power raised. watching that which twitches and dances to the power strummed. The tumult and power stroked through oil, canvas, her body as she waits her costume tonight, her pleasure to conduit power wildly. A split mattress, a splintered bush, a fuck taboo, fuck me harder, approach the trees themselves for notice, see if this power raises rain, or shine, or breeze, or more mewing from a race unfit to bear its dreams. A few of them architects, a handful musicians, but shred so easily by the power they raise a thousand from one to briefly stroke. But again tonight the power is raised, the bastards about give way, nature will tell everything if we cease to ask, cease to ignore. The trees are ready, the kittens, piranhas, typhoons already. Power raised again tonight, no answers, no puzzles, cherry blossoms, no walls, spit in your hands and get ready to clobber the cosmos, or face mask. The blood to equal the better one's dreams, to follow the lick steadily from breast to belly, bush to back, to give over to her tongue, or his tongue, or their several touches, to release it, to release to the deeper danger which hardly murmurs at dusk. Fuck him, fuck her, fuck them when the moon roars up from the horizon. Begin with tears, begin with flail. The power is raised, the trees won't notice the grind but for the sparks. The trees know we call it love, that we have a thousand languages to shroud and clean just one word. The sky is smacked with our love, frenzies and loss. The birds approach us, instruct us to wait, to listen, to learn how to give, how to receive, how identity merges within the flock and coalesces into the egg. Dogs won't abandon us, remembering love still. The power raised, perhaps even a notice tonight by this electrical universe. Love the aching puzzle, no puzzles, no questions. Love a steam of flicking diamonds, an endless smoke, a flu. Love the pool of footful maybes. Love the curing smoke, love the birthing pyre, love restraint, confusion, liberty, the power raised tonight while all awaits us. Your blue eyes far tonight as the trees await, as I'm told ascend, but do not yet, something remains here, in the strews and the beams, something remains, no puzzles, no answers, neither tattered nor invincible, something remains, some string of notes, blue-eyed and blonde, something to explain the gleam, the pitch, something the trees and sky and dimensions many will allow me, something important, a steam, a smoke, a flu, the power raised tonight, the power stroked, the power strummed, the mortal tyrant within again crushed, no answers, no puzzles, and my eventual swoop into you, and a greater music, and a greater silence. My blankness, your blankness, the company of men and women, a cacophony of arguments, how to live, how to live, how to live and why. Life a beautiful fizzle between this blankness and that blankness. A lick, a taste, a squeal, no more. Perhaps again life an endless stroke along arousing veins and flesh, a set of she-lips opening wider and wider, because the need to be taken understood is the need to be shared. Our beat, our blood, our come in my mouth as I kiss you and you taste me tasting you. Life may be a scripture to be puzzled, what figure sums too fine in a shell. A finger dabbed in red runs her lips to lips, paints nether and further, she wants to bite it, she wants it to continue. Yes, a scripture, sins and footnotes equated with starlight and fancy. The animals are merely our rides, dinner, fun. Or war, principles aligned with cannons, so many babies in square feet per victory. My blankness, your blankness, the crooked chimes and the stray pigeon's nest on the old porch with shattered windows. Something to puff slow, mellow slow, man. Count the beats, muse on the blood. It's all good, let it flow. Hunger, but always beautifully. Puppies to feed, find the drums, slack-ass cosmic mysticism. Grow the bud and smile, or power, moonlight, orgasm, water, blood and land, art more fierce than any other thought, art the thought of God and the thought of no God, art till she trembles, till she stills, till she understands just fucking pose, as all the scripture and governance she will ever need, till she understands that the reward is reciprocation, symbiosis. Worship it, but do not touch until you understand it is yours, ours. Say it. Till she understands new clay and green fields is worship. Till she remembers. Art not the object it appears. Art the release. Heart the pyre, heart the last drop never quite swallowed. Heart the hardest nipple, heart the brave book of blank pages. Wear this, just fucking pose. My blankness, your blankness. Wear this too, just fucking pose. My turn next, our turn last. How to live, how to live, how to live and why. Her hair red in every dream I've ever had. Blue eyes of flaming stone, knows how to pose. Knows what she tastes like to me, knows. Every poem of poke in her pretty, wants it rougher, always wants it rougher. Make me cry and I will stay. My blankness, your blankness. Make me beg, make me fizzle, scratch my fur, raw my leaves, claw my starlight. Listen to the music that trickles out. Blankness, blankness. Mark me with your nonsense, your artist's need to name and know. You'll never get deep enough. You will never get the last drop. I make art because I have forgotten how to tell the truth. The truth of a remembered memory of a hand. Feeling what an emotion's emotion of a face is like. How hell and sunsets are adjectivally potent. Lingual strategies, a murk shilled as matrix, a twinge called dream, damp hot air hustled as rain, basis for music, the lies of any color summoned, the words cock and cunt and fuck used like ideas, you have no breasts to inspire me, nothing. I gain more from stripping a tree, my beloved trees, and burning down the ancient cemetery where I confess little to nobody. I make art because I have forgotten how to tell the truth, confessions and damnation. Meaning called from lifeless bones. Childhood. Become a new fool in service of her night. It's rushing hours, rushing lights, wishing hours, holy emptiness. Holier music, strums of starlight, no death. Just become a different range of rhythms. Higher colors, become the word love. Ease roots from this mortal soil, its life-thinning mix of regret and sensation. No hellos, no goodbyes. Each leaf's blood weaned of grab and grief. Entropy's wailing smell. Vision rising, colors and bells, become a new fool in service of her night. Her heating touch, remembrances of willow trees and crab apples, wagons and children, an ancient fire a night's suicide put out. No direction but home. A fruit fallen lying in the grass, its skin gleams finely and brokenly, cleft from its tribe, now beginning its dreaming. A hunger builds within its raging song. A cluster of moans gives way to a single trill, high and clear, simple as sunlight and death. No direction but home. No direction but home. The wider sky, the deeper magic, wanes comfort, bluer breezes, bluer grasses, bluer tempos. The gift of life, life's visible promise, creatures and leaves moving slower. The edges of the world less scribed, more paint brushes dream, less pencils answer. No direction but home, no direction but home. Dream to wrap a thousand trunks in chantless rhythm, pour stream and sunshine into a dangerous exchange of roles. Cut into the fearful arrogance of men, whip weather with garden and arroyo. Die twice daily like this, better to eat and shit other times. No direction but home, no direction but home. Comfort and fire, the mystery of dust, querying creatures, loose fouled thoughts, begin again. Comfort and forgetting, history dwindling to a moment, another. Begin again, sunlight and death simple again. Dreams of my seeds, shimmering. No direction but home, no direction but home. Night raging, a herd wild, grieving, unsure, lost, clues everywhere, seeds everywhere, seed and dreams and water and sunlight, a thousand chantless rhythms now ragged with melody, seeds preach of the starshine and stream within, sugar and maya, no direction but home, no direction but home. What remains a holy emptiness, a fruit fallen lying in the grass, its skin gleaming finely and brokenly, beyond cleaving and dreaming, beyond hunger, just a song becoming itself forever. Traveling simple as sunlight and death. No direction but home. No direction but home. 420 again, raise the power. Fingers twined with smoke. Grown green and good. Seekers and outlaws across the land. Grown green and good. Raise the power. Become seeds for some new star's quest. But I'm in my bed right now, brothers and sisters. No puff to play. No hands to twine. Just milky nocturnes, a power of trying to raise, part kindness, part stiff belly, wanting to be willing to be more than free, to be committed in the shit and the joy, 10,000 words on a rap, then 10,000 raps, risks and revels, fear, all night burns, rawness, bravery, open hands, randy heart, a puff for fraternity, another for conviction, grown green and good, seeds for some new star's quest, like the few freak bees seeking the eye of the next honey. Finally, all glory passeth, continue. A greater music and a greater silence, tonight finally understood, is flow, not time, a symphony for strings and winds, a mountain ballet, an old growth opera. Tonight the choice is always to play or not, the watching sheep, the feeding swine. Stumble into the night with open hands, discover wider sky, deeper magic, all creation in motion, buzzing, the blood, skin, and breath of the night, a festival of movement, feeding on change, chew, swallow, mitosis, entropy, a fruit fallen and lying in the grass, a bomb of sugar water, another juice in the rhythm, flow where the preacher sees anarchy and the tyrant lassitude. But no waste tonight, not a note which does not elevate or depress perfectly, break down, burn, build again, wider sky, deeper magic. Beasts in the good green are dance masters again tonight, the blood hustling music even in the weakest skeleton, body seeking body for hard wet commerce. Love a messiah among the world's broken churches, gathering like loyal kittens, especially round the solitary beds, where a lover's lick and whisper lacks, not a creature forgotten though a man or woman may think so. But love is the birthing fire in bed, jungle, universe, seeking, exposing, compelling a glory, however yes it will pass, but teaching that it forever passes, the healing prayer at the heart of all creation. And nature tells this and more if the hand will but touch pink leaf, and eye but scan for hawk and swallow. Nature tells everything in the trot of an ant, the skulk of a possum, frosty march, twilight autumn, just a different way, a different path than tanks in the desert or suits in the glass room. A path not resistant to cycle and roll. A path unknowing of clocks and choices. A path no man may follow without tumbling. So we make art to remember our truth. Heart leashed lightning, harp a love tree. Seeking ever the wider sky, the deeper magic. Letting flash our seeds and our rhythm. Sometimes finding a greater music, a greater silence. A brief name for the unknown pain, all upon our hearts. Arriving on good nights in a rainforest, a small fire, a mug of tea, a puff, a joke, a happy cry.
Intertwined with rock star. So you wanna be a rocket? To be a Jew.
What?